guest is a leading expert in council tax and housing law with over three decades of experience navigating one of Britain's most complex areas of taxation. Alan Murdy is a barrister who has handled numerous test cases in both higher and lower tribunals and courts. He serves as the long-term editor of the Council Tax Handbook for the Child Poverty Action Group, and it literally is the definitive guide on council tax law. And he's also chairman of Nucleus Legal Advice Centre, which is a West London-based organisation dedicated to providing access to justice. Alan also delivers training for the Institute of Money Advisors and works as a consultant on local government law for LexisNexis. He is a member of the HMO Action Group, of which I'm also a member, who successfully changed the law on council tax and HMO rooms in 2023. Alan's expertise has made him an invaluable resource for individuals, businesses, and public bodies dealing with council tax issues. And so we are delighted to have you as a guest today. Alan Murdy, morning. Well,
thank you. Good morning. Thank you very much, Wendy.
Now, Alan, obviously, you and I have had many discussions about council tax over the years and working together, as we have done for a number of years, on council tax issues to do, particularly with HMOs. I want to broaden this interview out further, though, because council tax is a huge area of local law, government taxation, local government taxation, and impacts so many people's lives. Can you give us a brief history of where it started, how it started, some of the stumbling blocks along the way, and bring us right up to date? What are the current issues that the country is facing when it comes to council tax?
Well, certainly. There's quite a lot there to unpack. First of all, history. Local taxation in one form or another has been around since 1601. And originally it was a system conceived called the rates, which was in essence a land tax or a property-based tax. Now that evolved over the next three centuries. And if we go back 100 years, local government expanded during this period. The modern world came into being. And originally it was set up as a system to support the poorest members of the community. That function continued into the 20th century. And it is the historic legacy of why we have local taxation. I mean, getting on a third of the council tax budget in some areas now is going on social care for the elderly and the disabled and so forth. So its function is still there. Over the last century and a half, all modern developed societies have expanded to a degree, you know, even beyond what could have been anticipated in the mid-19th century, which was a very progressive period. We end up with a system of rating, which has carried on with certain throwbacks, certain relics that go back many, many years. It's an accumulation of laws over many, many years. In Britain, it's been reformed. The rate system was reformed periodically, 1925, 1948 after the Second World War, and there was a great need to rebuild, 1967. And we come up to 1988, when there was a major reform of business rates taxation, which is still with us under what's called the Local Government Finance Act 1988. But it also brought in the ill-fated experiment of the poll tax, which was an attempt to sweep away the previous 300 years of a land tax and replace it with basically a head tax. That basically you were liable for tax simply for existing, with very few exceptions. And now that had last been tried in back in the time of the Peasants' Revolt in the short-lived poll taxes of 1380 and 1382. It was not a success this time round. It was the end of Margaret Thatcher's career. She'd been in government for 11 years. It left the then Conservative government led by John Major with a bit of a problem. He, at the time, there was a man called Michael Heseltine, who wanted to be the Prime Minister. John Major wasn't keen on having a rival, I suspect, and he put Minister Heseltine in charge of sorting out the muddle of the poll tax. And so what they did was they created what we have now, the council tax. The council tax basically was a return in part to the land based model of taxation, but also it retained certain elements of personal liability from the still twitching poll tax. And so it can be understood as a cross between a land tax and a personal tax. It's effectively saved the Conservative government because poll tax was massively unpopular. Millions of people didn't pay it. It was largely uncollectible. There were many, many problems with it, which goes to show you can't change things rapidly in a country with such embedded institutions and systems and as old as Great Britain. So it didn't happen there. In fact, they never brought in either the poll tax or the council tax in Northern Ireland. They still labour under a version of the old rate system. So we've ended up with the council tax. So it was basically to save the Conservative government of 1992, the return to a property-based system based on 8 property bans in England. That system carried on till 2012, when it became necessary to bail out the banks. So they then had to bring in the Local Government Finance Act 2012, which was brought in some major amendments to council tax. Now, when council tax, I'm sorry, this is turning into a bit of a lecture for you, Wendy, but
it's very interesting though. This context is so important to understand where it's come from. And I think, again, I've heard you speak about this, of course, before, but I've learned a lot about this. You know, the historical context for taxation is critical in terms of what policymakers need to be addressing in the future. So this is relevant. Please keep going. I don't want to stop your flow.
I'm trying to give you a potted history. I'm afraid it is complicated. It's complicated even for me, and I've been immersed in this field for over 35 years. So if you could bear with me just a little longer, to say 2012, we had a major overhaul of a key part of the council tax system. As I said, council tax was a return to a property-based system based on the value of your home in 8 theoretical value bands. Part of the plank of the foundations of council tax in 1992 was it would also provide a system of up to 100% benefit to cover those who could not afford to pay it. Now, this was called council tax benefit. It was a Land's End, John O'Groats taxation system. It was the same rate wherever you were in the country. Effectively, for the poorest members of the community, the elderly, those on low incomes, those who are unemployed, you could effectively claim up to 100% benefit to cover your local tax liability. Now, what they did in 2012, this was part of the government localisation scheme under Minister Eric Pickles, was the Localism Act said all the power in theory is supposed to go back to local government. And instead of Whitehall setting council tax benefit, we shall scrap council tax benefit, which we did as part of the wider welfare reforms of the period. Under the Welfare Reform Act, Section 33 took away council tax benefit. In its place, it was replaced by what is called the council tax reduction scheme, which is decided in its details locally. That is, we've got over 300 councils in England, 22 in Wales, each of them 14 in Scotland at this point. Each of those councils makes up its own level of support that it gives to people on low incomes under 60. So you scrap,
and that would explain why We have so many variations across local councils in the way that these benefits or these advantages are delivered. That you see some areas, for example, presumably this also relates to things like empty property council tax levels. A few years ago, they've scrapped this now, of course, but you used to be able to get relief if your property had been empty for 8 weeks, for example. But in some areas, it would be 6 months or it'd be a year. And presumably that the Localism Act allowed those local councils to be able to make their own decisions about many other matters aside from the beneficial area.
Indeed. I mean, it was one of a raft of measures. The big change was the localisation of council tax support, because the problem was, whereas Whitehall from the centre decided what the rate of support was nationally, unfortunately switching it to local authorities meant it comes down to the people in your town hall and councillors to come up with what balance their books and come up with whatever rate of support they're going to give, if any, for people working age adults under 60. So that's why you've got this enormous amount of variations. It's almost like year zero. You try to start it all over again. Problem is, of course, town hall, your average town hall, best will in the world, they have no idea how to build a benefit system for people. They've been reliant for 20 years on central government. They don't have all the resources of central government. So they do their best. And in fact, the government has to issue a default scheme, which is basically a complex system of support, which most councils actually just copy, then tinker round the edges with, subject to their own budgetary restrictions and requirements. Now, the upshot for it, the real big difference, is where the problems have all emerged. And it was already inherent in the legislation, because Eric Bickle said, I will review this scheme after 3 years in 2016. It comes in on 1st of April 2013. He says, I will review it. He reviews it, does good as his word under the 2012 Act. And what they find is that default rates, that is, people unable to afford it to pay, or who are ending up being summons to court and ending up with liability orders, has increased by 40 to 50% nationally. Now, default rates.
So you would put that directly. So let's compare those, if you have those statistics, to prior to the 2012 Act. Mm-hmm. What was the level of defaults and bad debt, I suppose, that was being accrued prior to the Localism Act?
But prior to the Localism Act, the figures have been going up since about 2000. I would say, from my experience, council tax worked after a fashion between its inception in 1993 and about the year 2000. Now, what actually happened in 2000 wasn't so much a governmental decision, it was an administrative decision. It was the decision... basically, there was a bit of a fuss about too many people being paid too much benefit and people cheating the system. So they connected up the computers that sorted out social security benefits, decided centrally, those days job seekers allowance, income support, with your local town hall computer, which sorted out council tax benefit and in many cases housing benefit. Now, the problem was the computers started talking to each other, but it only needed one error to be put into the system somewhere, and it resulted in a complete cut-off of a person's benefit. Whereas, say, there'd been query about your performance or benefit or income or something about your job seeker's allowance, what would happen after 1999-2000 is the DWP computer would say, we've suspended the person's job seekers. It would send a signal off to the town hall where they, and it would, that computer at the town hall would cut off their housing benefit and it would cut off the council tax benefit. So not only did they have no income, but they also had no way to pay the rent quite often, and they couldn't pay the council tax. So as well as no income, they got rent arrears and they got they got council tax arrears. And then they have to try and overturn that. Now, I've worked solidly in that field. I wrote an article as long ago as 2008 for Advisor Magazine, which is online, called Computer Says No, which explains that the problems are very much computer-driven. Those accelerated. Come to 2012, 2013, I'm afraid the computers take over even more. And increasingly, you get an error somewhere in the system that just replicates now, as well as the general fall in income. Simultaneously, we also have the housing benefit cuts. We have the overall benefit cap. We have an increased sanctioning regime of unemployment related benefits, work related benefits, which I have to say didn't actually begin under the coalition government. They actually go now to back to spring 2009, where they were introduced by a now forgotten former Social Security minister called Kitty Usher. And it was a sanctioning system for people who felt that, you know, were felt not to be seeking work enough. And there's a whole combination of factors have come in, which have meant effectively growing numbers of people just don't have the means to pay that's coming in.
So we get to 2012.
Really rise after 2013.
So the introduction of council tax comes in. We've got these bandings. Are there nine bandings?
There's currently eight. Eight bandings in England. Your bands A to H. A is your bottom band, and is for dwellings that 33 years ago were valued at £40,000 or under. And H is your top band, which is broadly speaking three times more than band A. And in cases like that, you've got, in terms of proportion that you pay, but band H dwellings are those that in 1991 prices were valued at £320,000 or more.
So as you say, council tax seems to work generally, you know, okay. There's probably some problems because it was introduced very, very quickly after the failure of the introduction of poll tax. And we have a number of years where, you know, it settled down. Fast forward to the global financial crisis, of course, then all bets are off. Things have to start to be reorganized. We get to 2012, we get to the Localism Act. And this seems to completely alter the way that it's collected. And suddenly you've got local councils who are in charge of setting the levels, I should say. I don't want to use the word rate to confuse people, setting the levels of council tax. Now, is it also at this stage, Alan, where we start to see some of the variations in terms of distribution across those bands? So obviously, the banding was so that there could be a proportionate level of taxation set according to the value of that property, albeit traced right back to the start of 1991, 1992, when those property bandings were set. However, the other aspect of those proportionalities we've seen over time is that properties sometimes within band A to band C have been weighted disproportionately lightly for their share of council tax. And is that activity, has that been exacerbated by the 2012 Act?
Well, it has been in terms of the disappearance of certain discounts. You've got to remember that when the system was set up, it disproportionately favoured people in the top bands, because you can live in a rat-ridden hut and you will, the person in the mansion next door will only pay three times more than you do. Yet they may be occupying, you know, a terrifically large building worth an enormous amount. But they will only, on the basic council tax level, be paying three times more than the ruined tenement.
To play devil's advocate, I could argue that the reason for that is that the person who's living in that castle versus the person who's living in the rat infested tenement, both of them, in terms of their utilization of council services, may well be equivalent. And just because they live in a bigger house, should they have to pay more tax? Of course, this is an ongoing political debate.
Well, it's a very long going. I mean, turn to the pages of Professor Kanan's 1912 seminal work, The History of Rating in England, and you will find exactly that debate was going on before the First World War, because we just introduced the beginning of the modern welfare state in Britain, the old age pension system. This argument has been going around for a long time. Professor Kanan says, well, certainly let us have proportional amounts, but that's also going to mean, if it's going to work in terms of equity and principles of justice and fairness, it's going to mean a proportional redistribution of the land. Now, if we all start for having the same amount of land at the beginning, the same amount of property, then it's perfectly fair. But from an equitable point of view, and also I keep taking it back in so many discussions with people across the political spectrum, I ask them, what is local taxation for? Why do we have it? And it is there to protect the most vulnerable members of the community.
And that's because you concluded that because of your historical knowledge about the context of council tax.
Well, I also think it's the moral argument for it.
So currently, council tax is collected, and the rhetoric or the explanation for that taxation is to mend roads, manage roads, maintain roads, lighting, bin collections, local leisure centres, libraries.
Cemeteries, the list goes on and on, social services, all the aspects that can't be run centrally in a Soviet-style diktat. Things could be areas within the UK vary enormously. All kinds of factors. Yeah.
You would argue almost that we have completely changed the reason for collecting council tax, and we have, it's become sort of shrouded in these other reasons why we have local taxation, and why local taxation seems to have to go up every year regardless, obviously because of inflation and various other factors. In your argument, you would say if we could go back to more of a purist notion of local taxation, it should simply be there to support the poorest in society, to enable them to have the basic necessities of life. There would be a redistributionist element of it, but it would be much lower because, well, obviously many people's lives, they don't live in poverty. So there's always obviously a proportion of people who are poor proportionately, but local taxation would be the form that would support those people.
Well, it's that's why it's there. But I mean, there are many things. I mean, I buy a lot of books. I don't use my local library very much, but I don't object to paying money that goes for a library for the benefit. I see that there are certain things which are community assets, which everybody, through the generations, benefits from, parks and so forth. So I don't think there's anything wrong in principle in contributing to, the welfare of the human beings around me. Where we've gone wrong is to the extent that we've allowed things to forget the basic functions there and become increasingly taken over with complexities. That's one thing. The other thing to remember is that 4/5 of local funding actually still comes from central government. Now that has been cut back. That is a different, what has gone on there, including, I'm afraid to say, the mistake in 2010, again as part of the localism agenda, to allow local authorities to borrow money on the capital markets as well to fund projects. There's a whole lot of other things. Council tax is only currently about 19% of local authority income. And of course, you get things like major roads or major developments, which, or you know, even the ill-fated HS2 system, you've got things which spread across many local authority areas. And aside from that, we've also got, you know, billions in business rates, which are to be fed into the picture. People made a lot of fuss about the poll tax. What they didn't pick up on simultaneously in 1988 was the drastic effect of business rates and the way in which we changed those with the introduction of, whereas they had previously been set locally and muddled along fairly well. I mean, there was a lot of controversy in London with the former GLC, ended up getting abolished and so forth. And that was politics of London. But outside London, we had a business rate system, which it was nothing's ever perfect, but it worked. But the problem was we rushed in the uniform business rate system, which effectively starts to try and I think the original idea behind the uniform business rates, as far as I could ever find it out, was to supposedly promote the free market of capital around the country. So there would not be big rating variations that would stop businesses relocating around the country in a financial year. But the truth is, your average chip shop in Truro, in the course of a financial year, does not plan to relocate in Sheffield. So it was a non-starter for small businesses. And I mean, the results were really quite catastrophic on the high streets. People going on about high streets closing. We go back to 1990, 1991, admittedly a bit of collapse in property prices. But my local barbers in Bury St Edmunds, where I lived at the time, went from a rates bill in the first year of introduction from just over £750 annually to nearly £11,000. Now, that shut down Lloyd's the Barbers. That pattern was repeated across the country. I remember talking in 1990 to a man who'd worked in Poole in Dorset in the local heritage, civic society and so forth. He said, because of uniform business rates, all my work in this area has been for nothing. The last 20 years, because the uniform business rate has come along, it's closed down little shops that stood in the way of major modern, you know, great concrete redevelopment schemes for the best 5 or 10 years, and now they're swept away at once. So if you know, and this was a big issue about 15 years ago, how Britain was turning into clone towns. Well, the answer is business rates.
So what we have here is a disincentive for businesses to grow. Now, of course, we've got you have exemptions for business rates if you're under a certain level, or if you're in a building that's under a certain size, you can apply to be exempt. But nevertheless, those glass ceilings will still provide a disincentive for growth beyond that glass ceiling, a bit like the VAT threshold. So what impact do you think, although we're here to talk about council tax, that these two, as you say, are in part and parcel of the same bucket?
They're in tandem, yeah.
Yes, yes, exactly. What would you say, let's move it on to this podcast is the Reform Party podcast. In terms of the Reform Party, many policies are being thought through, many policies are being discussed, debated behind closed doors at the moment, and we're going to have to formulate policies on many of these different issues. If you were advising a Reform Party, what would you advise them to do, Alan?
Well, I'd give the same advice as I give to people from all political persuasions I talk to. That is, understand what you're talking about. Actually look at the legislation. Difficult, complex, it's hard, but it is not, as we found with the HMO reform group, You weren't trained as a lawyer, but when you looked at it, you could understand, you could actually understand the actual practical side of it. So people need to engage with the laws that are being created. Now, Parliament tends to be the last place that actually finds out what's going on, because you know they are wonderfully sheltered by a whole range of things, and a media which isn't necessarily what's in the public interest isn't necessarily interesting to the public. I'm well aware from years talking about local taxation, so you know I can understand that. But it's necessary to look actually at the bodies of law. I mean, again, and this does actually touch on local taxation, where I think the Reform Party needs to look at what it's saying is with this commitment, it wants to get rid of the Human Rights Act and wants to get us out of the European Convention. Now, it's not an original thing to say. David Cameron said exactly the same thing in 2014. He was going to do that. And then certain better informed people had a word in his ear. And I think that's where you need to find out what the implications would be.
So what you're referring to is the fact that the ECHR and the planks, if you like, of the way that we have established that law and the ramifications within our own other laws are part and parcel of those laws, and it is what you're saying, Alan, there, that to try and extract ourselves from the ECHR is going to be a much harder task than it looks.
No, not at all. We could leave it. No problem about it. We could, but again, it comes back to this question: why do we have the Human Rights Act? Well, the reason we have the Human Rights Act, yeah, we signed up for the ECHR as long ago as 1952 under the Churchill government. But the reason we have the Human Rights Act is not because suddenly the legal profession went all liberal. It's actually part of the Good Friday Agreement for Peace in Northern Ireland, that we should have a Human Rights Act in as part of the UK law, and that is part of the peace settlement in Ulster. And that was pointed out to David Cameron, and they decided they didn't want to open up the tinderbox of Northern Ireland again, which, yes, I think I'm old enough to remember bombs going off in British cities. I remember, you know, the terrible things that happened. So that's the first reason. Second reason, which no one else seems to have aired, but as you've asked me, is currently, I think, even Russia is nominally signed up for the Human Rights Act. I think it's only Belarus that isn't. Now, let's put yourself in a British citizen who gets into trouble abroad position. If UK doesn't have regard for the Human Rights Act and you get banged up abroad somewhere, why should they care about your human rights then? If you end up as a, you know, misfortunate British, you know, this kind of thing happens.
Yes, it does.
Coming into White's relevance to local taxation, this is my one contribution to human rights jurisprudence. Back in 1991, I was involved with a case of an unemployed man called Steve Benham, who was homeless. He lived in Poole. And Paul, he didn't pay his poll tax. He was living in his car. He got locked up for 30 days by Paul Magistrates Court for not paying poll tax he wasn't even liable for. At the time, there was no legal aid to get him out of jail. So myself and some other volunteer lawyers got involved with the case. And fortunately, it came to, because human rights wasn't really a great thing at the time, but it wasn't even the basis on which we managed to get him released from prison at that point. The upshot was we did manage to get him out of the High Court. The High Court 8 months later quashed his jailing. It was the start of many hundreds of actual successful overturnings of imprisonment. But the National Council for Civil Liberties at the time, man called John Woodham, was the solicitor. He said, well, this is actually a human rights act point. So Benham's case went all the way to Europe because it was the position up until 1995 that if you failed to pay a parking fine, even, you could be sent to prison for by magistrates, non-payment of fine, and there was no legal aid if it wasn't even your vehicle. If your previous, you could end up in jail with no right to a lawyer paid for by the state or legal aid to protect you. And it was only because we had the European intervention of the European Court in Benham's case that we changed the law. And since 1997, there were a whole load of compensation cases as well that went through. And again, we're not talking about, as it was said to me, even by a left-wing MP of the time, we're not talking about bearded Trotskyist polytechnic lecturers. We were talking about people like Mr. Perks of Wolverhampton, who was brain damaged as a child with meningitis, who got locked up for not paying a tax he wasn't even liable for. And so legal aid provision has come about, and that was my one contribution in helping that litigation begin that ended up with why we had the Human Rights Act. There's been similar things about proportionality on fines, that it really isn't a good idea to lock up a single mum on benefits with children for a small paltry fine. You know, this is actually what human rights law is about. I think people do need to do a basic bit of reading.
I think the challenge is absolutely right, Alan, that's critical to understand what the implications would be of getting rid of the Human Rights Act and withdrawing from the ECHR, and understanding what some of those implications would be of doing that, and some of the the legal precedents that have been set as a result. We all benefit from those. You're absolutely right. You know, we don't want to see single parents locked up for a small fine to the detriment of their children, who then might have to be taken into care. And the state is going to have to foot the bill. And it could cost huge amounts of money, which are completely unnecessary for a very, you know, small offence. There are always trade-offs. And I think what we've got to consider is what are the incentives that the law is setting up, and what are the trade-offs? And, we're not going to, I don't want to expand this conversation too much into some of the other trade-offs that we might have to make. But I think that it's a very important challenge. And I think you're absolutely right that politicians across all spectrum need to understand how the laws were constructed and passed, and to what end. I think that there's going to have to be more discussion about that. And I do know that these discussions about some of the precedents that have been set as a result of our thinking at the time, some of them have been very beneficial, and we don't necessarily want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. But on the other hand, now, is it having other consequences? In terms of immigration, but we could widen this discussion out, and I want to keep it to council tax if we may, Alan, because that's why you're here, that's why you're on. I'd like to move to thinking about some of the current issues that you see as being problematic in the council tax system, and I think some of your ideas and thoughts about what could be done to address those areas.
Well, I'll come back to a point I made earlier, which is the march of technology. Now, to an extent, that is inevitable in modern societies. I do take the throwaway point. We can't go back to vellum and quill pens and so forth. But I have to say that my experience over the last 25 years of seeing the march of technology in the local taxation field, I'm afraid it reduces my opinion for technology, because I've seen the system become increasingly inefficient. And the major problem I find with local authorities is navigating the system. Quite often, there have been too many cuts in effectively physical services, and with the system of appeals. When I started with local taxation. There were 56 tribunals around the country, and you had they were serviced and paid for, and you could get them. Now they have all closed completely, and we are meant to conduct appeals over council tax on a kind of glorified Zoom call. Now, this hasn't made the system any better, because I've seen the debt problems and the zeros get bigger and bigger, I'm afraid, on the bills and the cases I deal with. And technology has not helped. There's been it results in a fragmentation of decision making, and we need, part of the problems we've got with right across the justice system is goes back to a policy introduced by the then Justice Minister Jack Straw, 2007-2008, to start selling off the courts and tribunal buildings themselves. And so all the best ones got sold off, and the Cameron government, coalition government, repeated this in 2012. So there's fewer and fewer courts and tribunals. The ones that we've got, they've tried to replace stuff with technology. I mean, I don't have the up-to-date figures, but 2023, over 30,000 hours of court time were lost because of misfunctioning technology and IT. So it's not a panacea. It's made certain interest groups and companies very rich indeed. So there's clearly, I think, a need to actually go back to more localized physical decision-making. Now, people have probably been separated since COVID and find that a bit too daunting. But, oh my, it makes all the difference. If you're actually all in the same room together, you can at least be sure that the court or tribunal are actually looking at the same page of documents or evidence as you are, which we cannot guarantee if we have a virtual justice system.
I think that's a really valuable point. I think we have there is a risk that artificial intelligence will be sort of accepted as a panacea for all ills, and that artificial intelligence is the answer to all our problems. But when it comes to justice, and when it comes to deciding people's fate and making decisions based on legal rules and regulations as to whether that person has either breached the law in some way or committed a crime, this is people's lives we're talking about. And I think doing it pure on a paper-based automated system, which is what we see council tax being managed by currently, is very, very problematic, because nuances, reasons, evidence just seem to be ignored. And, you know, you and I, Alan, have had many occasions of working with people who have tried to make their case to the local authority about their council tax situation. And it just seems to have gone into what I call the council tax robot. And the council tax robot just spews out another letter. There's nobody actually there who understands enough to be able to listen to that person, to listen to their issues with council tax, or the misunderstandings that might have arisen around their particular case, and explain why something is the way it is, and why therefore either the council tax has been paid or has been overpaid or underpaid. And it seems that they're just processed like a sausage in a factory, and nobody gets to actually hear that case until it's gone so far down the line that the threat to that person is huge in terms of fines and bills.
Well, it is, and it should not be forgotten. This is the second area, is that there is not, in my experience, proper regulation of accounting of the money that comes in, and particularly when it goes to enforcement, it is not properly regulated. And because I have dealt with cases of enormous variations in bills. I'll give you a couple of examples. I had one case beginning of last year. Gentleman inherited property from his late father, premium applied, £33,000 council tax bill applied, fortunately came to me. By the time we finished negotiations, which took best about 8-9 months with the authority, because cases that I could have got sorted out within 3-4 weeks 25 years ago now span the months, even the year, let me say, because of precisely the problem you've identified, the fragmentation and lack of human discretion or intervention. And we ended up, and he didn't even have to pay all of it, but rather than pile the premium on the new owner, he took a bill of 19,000. Now, I've had other cases of, had a lady with a disabled husband who got stuck in another property during COVID in Wales. £24,000 demand rained down upon them. When I, by the time we finished, we got it down to 6,000. Had cases of a lady whose mother had died 4 years earlier, chased posthumously for alleged money. They'd actually sold the place, which, you know, was a bit of a mansion, but they were asking for 17,000. She ended up actually paying nothing after. I wish all my cases would end like this, but it is the scale of the errors now which can come in, particularly since 2015. This is why the landlord sector were particularly being penalised selectively, unfairly, unjustly. And that's a further wider point, is that this only really happens in local taxation. HMRC, there's a vast body of laws, and in fact there's a whole tax bar, and all barristers have to pass a tax exam and so forth in order to practice. There's a whole lot of really established legal principles. All that I ever do that is in at all in any way original, because all I ask is the system actually does what it is meant to do. We all follow the law, but that's not just the taxpayer, that's also the council, the court, the tribunal, everybody, valuation, or, you know, everyone should follow it. That's all I do. But all I would ask, I think, at this point is that established principles that govern any other tax and the way it's levied are actually brought into play in council tax, because there are some most extraordinary anomalies appearing. The fact that you can be chased, normally Inland Revenue will only go after you for 6-7 years, but I've had cases of people supposedly being chased for 20-year-old council tax bills. Now, yes, you know, the limitation period needs to be cleared up here, because just to give everybody a basic working certainty.
So is that limitation not written into law? Is that's not written into the 1992 Local Government Finance Act, for example?
Not as clearly as it should be. And again, this is a long seminar in itself. The limitation was never an issue, even in local taxation, till about 1953, because the system, old-fashioned, it did work along without too much of an issue. But there are problems with the Limitation Act in terms of how you interpret the 1980 Act in terms of a new computerized model based on reminder notices and liability orders. So nobody's sat down and done the reform of that principle. Another unfair thing about the empty property premium, and I did try to fight this for the best part of 3 years in tribunal cases, is that with the empty property premium, you can originally it seemed to have been written to make people who just speculated, bought property, left it empty for years, to actually pay something of a penalty for that kind of sort of reckless thing, blocking housing and so forth. Except the way the law has ended up being written to an extent and interpreted is that you can get councils, and I could name some, where the property can stand empty, say, for 10 years. It's then bought by a new owner, Now, yes, there is a 10 years worth of premium. A lot of money has accumulated. However, the way the law operates is the premium doesn't necessarily attach to the previous owner who left it vacant. It gets passed on to the new owner.
Which is ridiculous, isn't it? The liability of that previous owner is now the new owner's liability.
Buying a used car and finding that you have to pay the parking fines and speeding fines of the previous owner.
So, Alan, you are able to identify probably, I would say, at least 10 issues with the way that council tax is administered, the way that it is collected, probably the way it's used, although that's for a bigger discussion, a bigger debate. And a lot of your work has gone into addressing and supporting people, representing people who have been completely overlooked, I suppose, by the state, or they have been abused, you could argue, by the state and by the way that it has administered council tax. As you say, the fragmentation without any individual actually getting involved to oversee a case that comes and recognise the stupidity of it or the illogical element of it, to go, hang on a minute, this doesn't actually make sense, and this person has got a disabled husband and they shouldn't be paying this council tax on this other property because COVID separated them for 8 months. Whatever the actual details of those cases are, but you've been able to, by your knowledge of council tax law and also common law and other legal acts, you've been able to utilize that knowledge to be able to represent those people and save them huge amounts of money. But how many people don't know you? How many people don't realize that you can fight the system? How many people are stuck in a council tax hellhole right now, wondering what they should be doing and how they can get out of it? Because, as you say, the system is so complex and it is so automated that probably for many people who try and take action on their own behalf simply can't do it and either give in or give up.
Yep, well, I'm afraid that is, and that's the daily experience. As you mentioned at the beginning, I chair Law Centre in West London, and people are routinely, free legal advice community centre, which we've managed to keep going over the years. We've actually even managed to expand a little bit, but I'm never complacent. But we are facing record demand levels, and people are routinely walking through the surgery door, as so to speak, presenting with problems more complex than I trained on to be a barrister over 30 years ago. And there are all stages of litigation, and again, legal aid, cut back in legal aid for the last 25 years has compounded these things. So,
we're also simultaneously seeing a lack of collection of council tax, aren't we? We're seeing councils issuing bills for council tax, but yet I think there's a huge amount of council tax that just simply never gets collected.
Current arrears are probably about £500 million in England, I should say, quite easily. And of course, there's lots of unpaid liability orders. Again, I have all kinds of issues with liability orders I've been making for the best part of 15 years nearly. Yes. There are a lot of problems. It may be historically we are in one of these periods where there is going to have to be a root and branch reform of the local taxation system. It, as I said, it's happened periodically, and we are about ripe for it again. In fact, overdue, I would say. And this has probably got a lot more to do with wider economic forces and factors, to do with great many things, all coming together at once. So we live in interesting times, so far as anyone can find them interesting. But it does become very interesting when it's you. And so, and this is one of the problems, I think, with so much of local taxation and to do with welfare. When education goes wrong, middle class people tend to notice. When it's services affecting middle class people, they don't work out. They tend to make, you know, representations of their members of parliament. It becomes an issue in the media. It doesn't really, and the health service, when that goes wrong, people notice, they do something about it. But unfortunately, when it's benefits or local taxation, and local, as I said, we're talking about a fifth of your local authority's income here, and factors that people don't immediately notice unless they actually have a relative who's in care or on the receiving end, or a friend who's very unlucky. They don't actually realize what can go wrong. A lot of people seem to, you know, don't appreciate the problems, and this is this is what I said, is that quite often Parliament is the last place to find out what's actually happening.
Well, Alan, I'm going to wrap up what has been a fascinating hour for me, and whether the whole hour makes it to the podcast, I don't know. I'll leave it to our editor to decide. But I would like to say a huge thank you to you for your time today. It's been really fascinating. I do find listening to you very, very interesting. We might not always agree.
You're too kind. I mean, I appreciate having been talking about this stuff for many years.
Well, absolutely. I have your book on my shelf behind me. It's probably not the latest edition, but whenever I have a question about council tax, I always refer to your book, because it is the most comprehensive guide I've found about council tax in England and Wales. So, you know, that's a book to get. It might not be, you know, by your bedside, but you certainly should have it on your reference shelf.
Well, possibly as an aid to sleep, some people have commented.
But... possibly, yeah.
But there we go. Thank you.
Yeah, well, thank you very, very much indeed for being here, Alan. And anybody who really wants to contact you, well, I would suggest do a Google search on Alan Murdy and council tax. You'll find him. He's top of the list. He's, in my view, the number one expert in the UK on council tax. What he doesn't know, nobody knows. And it's been really an honour and a delight to have you today. Thank you for coming on the Reform Party podcast.
Well, thank you very much for having me.